nerd herd. Welcome to another episode of the Perpetual Notion Machine for May 28th, 2020. Tonight's a fun show with the PNM crew where we will discuss recent scientific and not so scientific ideas that we've all been grappling with together. Joining me tonight are Kevin Lauder-Young.
What up?
And Ari Clark.
Hey.
And Ari's kitten.
Toast.
Meow! Tonight we're going to try to be objective as we talk about some... We're going to discuss some listener questions. We're going to discuss some scientific questions we've been asked as scientists. And again, we're trying to be objective, to borrow a wrestling vernacular. It's not going to be a shoot, but we will be talking about works. One of the criticisms that, as I understand it, Wart has received recently is that they don't have enough scientists on the air talking about these big questions dogging science right now. So we scientists are here. And some of these scientists are, from a scientist's perspective, a deep vein for conversation. Some of them, quite frankly, we don't really know where to begin parsing. So for what it's worth, here are the assessment of three scientists with decades of combined experience in infectious disease research. You know, it's not nothing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the first thing that I want to start out with, Kevin, you had mentioned that you had that you'd done some research about trust and how that relates to science.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, I think when you're talking about how people respond to scientific information, there's a diversity of reactions that you get, right? And are especially as people who are, you know, sort of science hoorah, or those of us in science, we tend to assume that, well, the people who disagree with the scientific consensus or who are resistant just don't know enough and we need to inform them. And the sort of knee-jerk reaction is to inform. But as a number of UW communications vets would tell you, I just saw Dominique Brassard was in a 538 article today, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Shout out to Dominique, who's awesome. The knowledge deficit model, which is the technical name for that, tell more people more information, and they'll understand it more and you know, agree with it more and be more science hoorah. Generally, it's not true. Like, if you tell people more information, that doesn't necessarily mean that they trust it more or they trust scientists more. You have to have a more nuanced approach.
Right. So it's not necessarily a deficit that we're required to fill, per se. It's more of a communication, and it involves a lot more trust and sort of building rapport with each other.
Yeah. But generally, the main takeaway I would say is that, like, trust in science is actually holding pretty strong and has held strong, as strong as any other institution over the last 40 years since the major institutions have been tracked. So, you know, if it seems all hope is lost, take some solace in that datum.
Yeah, for what it's worth. Well, that's good. So again, as members of this community, you know, as scientists of this community, we're here because we do genuinely care about you guys, you know, about bringing everybody together. The medicine community is awesome. It's a combination of students, you know, of academics, of people who work in various industries or various trades, people who don't work at all, you know, like it's a little bit of everything. So what we want to do is kind of have a conversation about some of these ideas, right? And some of them, you know, have been brought to the attention of Wart. So I guess with this idea in mind that what we're doing is we're building trust. We're not necessarily filling a hole. We don't believe that, you know, people that, you know, that believe one thing or another are stupid or bad people. It's really is nothing like that. You know, people believe things for good reasons. But there is, as always, a difference between belief and understanding. So I think that if we could give you a takeaway for anything tonight, I hope that you'll consider this concept of understanding versus belief and how it sort of influences you in your own life. So, start with one of the easy listener questions, something that had come up at the office in staff meetings. How long does virus exist in the air? How long does it exist on surfaces? It seems like no one agrees, right? And that's, you know, that's pretty true. Like, do you guys have any thoughts about this?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is that, like, you'll see different numbers or different lengths of time quoted by different news sources, and a lot of that comes from different studies where people are trying to recreate what would happen to a real person in real life as best as they can in the lab. But a lot of times, a laboratory setting and an actual real life setting are pretty different. So lots of different scientists are trying to tackle the problem different ways, which is really great because each of those experiments gets a little bit closer to the truth of the matter. So I would say, like, when you're reading numbers, to take it maybe with a grain of salt, but also to try to go deeper and maybe find the source and try to understand how the experiment actually happened and decide whether or not you think that's a good model for yourself.
Right.
Or someone.
Sure. Or you can read multiple sources, and, you know, multiple sources can all be true at the same time, just depending on small variations between the studies and how they were done.
Right.
So I did have a couple, in looking at some of the sources that are easily available with a Google search, I did have a couple caveats, just to be a pedantic scientist. viruses don't survive outside the body, and that's because they aren't alive. Most scientists don't consider viruses to be a living organism. They are obliged to live in another cell. They can't replicate on their own, and that's one of the defining features of a living thing. So they can be active, they can be viable, but they aren't alive. So that's another thing to take with a grain of salt. If you're just looking at titles, I know as a scientist, I get a little judgy about titles that say, how long can viruses live outside the body? It's like, I already know the answer to that one. But it brings me to another important point. One of the differences between some of these studies is that detectable virus is not the same thing as viable virus. And this is something that I don't think gets a lot of airtime. It's a different test. So as most people are probably aware, SARS-CoV-2 is usually detected using a PCR test, and that's amplifying DNA to create a signal, basically, to see if you find these specific DNA markers that constitute the genome of a virus. So that doesn't tell you if it's living or dead, because again, living, dead, it's easy to make the mistake, right? It doesn't tell you if it's viable or if it's not viable. It just tells you that there is the presence. So if you're done having an infection and you just sort of have this viral shed where the genome could still be present, but not actively infecting you, you could still detect that, right? It's a different test to see if that virus is still viable, where you would infect cells, basically. And the other thing too, is that you can detect a very small amount of DNA. And again, that might be enough to detect that it's there, but not that it's active. How much virus would you need to actually be infected? How much viable virus would you actually need to become infected? That's another great question, and that's something that I think that people don't necessarily have a great handle on yet. It could be something in the range of 1,000 viable particles to 10,000 viable particles, but it's not one or two. So... That's something else to keep in mind, is that just because there's been an exposure in the smallest way doesn't necessarily mean. And that's something that we would want to know to protect our own best interest, right? You know, like, does it aerosolize? Does it stay on surfaces? So
I think we did bring it up, or maybe I brought it up. I remember talking about it when we did a COVID episode a couple months back in the studio, a different time. And we were talking about what's the likelihood of being an asymptomatic carrier. And I think I cited a study that said that they were potentially detecting non-virulent DNA,
mm-hmm. yeah.
or RNA, I guess, in this case. And that's not conclusive. But of course, at this point, we know a little bit more about it. And I think that gets to, and Ariel talked about something that I think is a really key pattern for how people react to science in general, scientific studies. You know, there's this habit of, you know, you find out chocolate's good for you, and then the next day you find out chocolate's bad for you. And just because you, first of all, let's put aside that those are reported somewhat inaccurately often. But the fact that there's conflicting information leads to a lot of people to kind of throw up their hands and being like, mm-hmm. and, you know, so essentially say like, well, none of it is really conclusive at all anyway. But there's a difference between different findings, which is expected in science. That is like how science works.
For sure. Yeah.
And the consensus. The consensus opinion is essentially a body of scientific work that tends to agree with the premise. So like, so a lot of this new information that we're getting about the coronavirus, there's not going to be much of a consensus because it's novel, right? I mean, it's in the name, novel coronavirus, right? However, like general principles of epidemiology, how things spread, you know, infection rates, if we know infection rates, what's, mm-hmm. you know, what's the outcome population-wide, there are strong consensuses on those things, given the you know, the factors. And so, you know, it's not the same thing to say, we don't know how long it lives on cardboard, lives, quote unquote.
Right? It's so hard to stop saying.
But like the fact that that's inconclusive does not mean that, you know, when Fauci talks about flattening the curve and stuff like that, that it's just as up in the air. It's not as up in the air.
No.
It's, those epidemiological bases are way more established. They're way more consensus. And so that's one key thing to look for in any of this stuff. If you hear a consenting or a differing opinion, a differing study, that's okay. Try to find what the consensus is, if there is one.
Right.
Yeah. So speaking of dissenting opinion, the next one I'm going to look at, it was a kind of a longer call, but I'm going to pick out some pieces of questions or concerns that this listener had that they had wanted to communicate to address. So, and this was some time back. This is I want to say at least a month ago that this was received. So things have changed a lot. So maybe things have changed for this person. The person was saying, I don't think this coronavirus is anywhere nearly as dangerous, not even close, like the numbers that have come from California. So in Wisconsin, maybe the response was disproportionate to what was happening in California, where there were a lot more people. And that's a valid mm-hmm. concern, you know. Wait,
they're saying that they think it's a different virus?
Nope. Just saying that it's not as dangerous to us here in Wisconsin as it is for California. That's my understanding of the statement.
The risk is different, yeah.
Right. The risk to the economy is different. They continued that they are worried about the economy collapsing and this leading to martial law, which would be terrible. Running out of food, running out of jobs for people. I mean, there's a big step between the two things. So I think that this is something that's really easy to do, is to kind of equate one thing happening to several steps down the line, and then those two things being equivalent. And this is, I believe, the straw man argument. So it's like saying, because, you know, you can set up sort of an easy to defend idea, and then you spend so much time sort of saying like, oh, well, we're not going to go into martial law. But you know, I think that to people who are genuinely concerned, it's easy to make these kinds of assumptions. Because then what's worse than that is living in a surveillance state, right? With someone like Bill Gates, who doesn't even have a college degree. Ari, fact check that. He doesn't have a college degree. And to my research, I don't think Steve Jobs did either.
And I would have gotten away with it if it weren't for you meddling liberals.
Exposed. You know, I mean, computer science was kind of in its infancy back then.
Yeah.
So they concluded with, it seems like a huge giant conspiracy coming through to me. So this is not, I mean, this is a growing concern of people, you know, like we talked about how people have trust in scientists, and yet at the same time, there's this vein of lack of trust of technology and, you know, those in charge using what is very powerful technology for ill. I mean, a lot of these are emotionally tied, right? At some point, these beliefs can become almost a cultural affiliation. Right. So once you start taking one thing into account, a lot of these other beliefs will sort of follow, you know, like, so I guess, what are you guys' thoughts on how somebody can go from, I'm concerned that we're, you know, overblowing the situation with the virus to Bill Gates is trying to track us all, and 5G towers are responsible for it.
I guess I can start. I think that a lot, like, so with this listener's comment in front of me, I think that, like, we're living in a scary situation where things are changing so fast, and people are scared about getting sick. They're scared about their family getting sick, but then they're also scared about losing their job. And then that leads to being scared about bigger things. And I feel like, especially like in movies about how this thing plays out, they typically end up poorly, like going into martial law or running out of food. And so I think it was very easy for people to latch on to those kind of ideas and think that that might happen to them. But luckily, we don't live in a movie, like a Hollywood set. And a lot of these fears are, don't have, like, are reasonable. And I understand, not reasonable, but I understand where they come from.
Mm-hmm.
But luckily, aren't really founded on evidence to support that those things could happen.
Right. There's no absence of evidence is not proof that it doesn't happen.
Right.
But it does require some sort of evidence for these extraordinary claims, right?
Mm-hmm.
There is definitely evidence of abuse of emergency situations, even in the U.S. Right? We have Japanese internment camps and stuff, you know. But yeah, I mean, I think my strategy, and this is totally throwing anything I know, all the data I know about trust and science out the window for a second. I don't know if it disagrees with it, but it's just kind of ignoring it. It's just my sort of go-to reaction. I tend to have pretty strong, acquiescence bias, where you want to, confirmation bias. You want to like kind of say yes to people.
Mm-hmm.
So I tend to try to find some middle ground, because I do think like, yeah, there are legitimate concerns about the economy, about government overstretching. There are legitimate concerns about, you know,
privacy,
things, you know, some of the data not matching between different studies, like the fact that we have uncertainty about some of these details, like that matters. That is something to be concerned about. What I think the reason I tend to do that so regularly is because when the next step happens, if it happens, where they say, oh, well, thus it was made in a lab or it was manufactured by Bill Gates or whatever, then I have a little bit of credibility with the person to say, yeah, no. It's like we were talking about with the intellectual dark web a couple weeks back, where like you can go one click in one direction and you have very, you know, credible, quote unquote, credible debate, and another direction you're at Alex Jones, whatever conspiracy theory, is trying to like amplify that middle ground where like, yeah, these are concerns for all of us and we need to find the gray area that best threads the needle, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think another, we could talk a little bit more about how scientists sort of view these things too, but you know, there's a lot of comfort in conspiracy theories, right? Because conspiracy theories can help people feel like they live in a world of order where people in charge, good or bad, you know, have power and they can control the situation. So it's hard to acknowledge that we live in a chaotic universe that really doesn't care about us.
Yeah, it sucks.
It does, but we can't in a chaotic world guarantee answers to questions. You know, scientists are kind of trained to accept this ambiguity, and some people seem to be more comfortable embracing this ambiguity than others. So we can often be sort of dismissive of these sorts of ideas, but there is a lot of comfort, you know, and camaraderie in these ideas and the us against the world, you know, bringing people together, especially in times where people feel so divided and scared. Like you need something to defend, you know, you need to kind of stake your claim somewhere. And I just feel like it's unfortunate that it's a lot of times very divisive ideas.
Yeah.
So another part to that question, another question somebody called in, had some criticism about the scientists that were brought in on WRT. So he'd asked that they put on real scientists. And it would always kind of come back to this concept of chemtrails. And it was sort of this leading, like a lot of leading questions of, oh, you know, if we bring in a scientist who disagrees with the existence of chemtrails, they're either lying or they're being lied to, or they're part of the cover-up. So have you guys ever been lied to or ever knowingly been part of a scientific cover-up? And how would you know?
Oh, I think that last question is really hard. How would you know if it's so widespread?
Right.
I guess maybe you wouldn't. I don't know. But also, like, the idea of, like, a real scientist, like, Kelly, are you a real scientist? Kevin, are you a real scientist?
There I mean, that's how I make money.
Yeah. I mean, it would be pretty spectacular to me that I could think that I'm a real scientist, but actually have been lied to and be a part of an elaborate cover-up this whole time. That would be... Whoever's in charge should get a raise.
Right. They'd be... Because the amount of work that would go into that and grooming everybody and every institution from community colleges to private universities...
The private sector.
And the private sector, right. Where you could get everybody on the same page to do the same thing, to walk in lockstep, right? Yeah. Without any whistleblowers. or with, you know, precious few whistleblowers. I mean, it's just the amount of work that would go into that is just buck wild. And the simpler solution is that people aren't that good at orchestrating these kinds of things. So, I mean, I feel like in science, we're knee-jerk contrarians a lot of times. And if we don't agree with something, we speak up. That's what we're sort of trained to do. So I just think it would be really difficult to get something over on the scientific community just because we are so... so contrarian with each other.
I feel like we should start broadcasting lab meetings and just so people can see how we eviscerate each other on basic things.
It's bitey, yeah.
For sure. Yeah. Well, it reminds me of, like, not necessarily a coronavirus related debunking that I've had to do in the past, but I could very easily see this becoming a COVID related issue where people will often ask me if I think as a scientist that there's like a secret cure to X disease, oftentimes cancer. And I just, beyond the fact that like cancer is like such a complicated issue that we can never have a single cure, the idea that like a person like me, a graduate student in a lab, could work on this cure, find it to be working, and then have someone say, no, we're not talking about that. It's a secret. We're not going to put it to market. Yeah. And somehow be able to silence the whole lab or the whole department that knows about this research is beyond me.
Governments don't really have as much sway in what we do as people, I think, just sort of believe. they're not. It's not really like a day-to-day consideration, I think, for most research labs.
Right.
Yeah, because like there are unfortunate incentives in scientists publishing, and you know, and I'm not going to necessarily get into those. They're not such that they should fuel such conspiracy theories. Maybe if all of science were corporate and, you know, all profit based, but it's just not the case. I mean, if you found some like treatment that totally blew up pharma in terms of, you know, undermining them, you would be set for the rest of your career. And it's just not the same thing with publicly funded research, which is so much of research. And so I think, you know, there's always this sort of like hinting at incentive structures without totally naming what's going on. And there is no naming it, I think, because it's just not strong enough, unfortunately. Sometimes I wish we were paid a little bit more, but that's okay.
Yeah. Or a little more focused in what we're doing.
Right. Yeah. Well, I guess I think a simpler message is just that scientists are just like everyone else. And we are generally, I would hope, good people who came into this field to do good and help people and would speak out to make sure that our work actually helped people, regardless of the situation.
Yeah.
And I would hope that would build trust with the community, taking a step back and realizing that we're not like a faceless person in a lab coat.
Right.
Say the people that you can't see over your radio waves.
Right.
Well, I want to give you guys a little bit of time to talk about things that have come up with you in discussion for you recently, but I just want to end on this idea to challenge people, you know, what would it take for you to change a belief, you know, if it's something you feel strongly about, find a belief where if you stop believing in it, it would change who you are as a person. about something like COVID or about, you know, and really consider that and see where the data goes with it. You know, it should be pretty compelling. But anyway, so did you guys have anything else you wanted to talk about regarding weird science questions that have come up with friends and family now that you're professionals?
Well, I guess, I mean, I've been doing a lot of the grunt work on Facebook, trying to help people find sources that are accurate. And I guess I don't necessarily have any like specific things to talk about that I've debunked, but more a strategy for fellow do-gooders out there to try to keep things really professional and really unpolitical. I think the politicization of COVID research is really working against everybody's, the best welfare interest of everybody.
It's very Sisyphusian of you.
Yes.
Well, and taking politics out of it increases your credibility with people who would be less susceptible to hear you out otherwise.
Right. And there are a lot of scientists that really live by that, that try not to politicize what they do. And I think that whether they want to or not, a lot of times they get involved in politics.
Yeah.
One way or the other. So I saw somebody on my Facebook post, and maybe everybody's seen this before, that there's, if you're looking at peppers, if you're picking out bell peppers, there's two genders. There's male and female. I didn't debunk that one. I let her keep it. I don't think there's really any reason to shatter the innocence of somebody by talking about plant genetics, because that's that is not the realm of innocence. There's a lot of weird stuff that goes on in plant genetics.
Right. Well, a non-plant scientist, I had to look at that one twice in the Google Doc. Like,
yeah,
I guess they don't have gender. I haven't heard.
3N. Yeah, that was one. There was somebody that had sent an article around a mailing list about somebody who was talking about the Wuhan virus, and it was sort of this one man's crusade to expose the fact that there is this cover up. I get kind of protective about Chinese scientists because I know a lot of Chinese nationals who are scientists, or people from Taiwan who are scientists, people from all over Asia who are scientists, and it just breaks my heart to hear people equating scientists from Wuhan as conspirators of the government. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, just like people all over the world, not everybody agrees with the government. Some people do, and that's fine, but it's neither here nor there. You know, like the researchers, and we had a longstanding collaboration with them that was meant to be globally helpful. And to end that relationship is just so sad. And I really hope that people can understand that there is an element of maybe some racism there, or some fear of outsiders, I guess, you know?
Hear, hear.
Which is a real bummer. I guess we could finish on this too. We've been through the process of learning and relearning as this the COVID-19 situation developed, as we learned more about SARS-CoV. I started out with a hot take that I didn't care about the coronavirus and that it was just going to blow over. That wasn't true. Next, we kind of took pot shots at masks and said that masks just make you feel better and they don't actually do anything. We've all changed our tune about that too. So, so scientific hypocrisy, but it's also, it's growth, right?
Yeah, this is the one thing, I don't have much to debunk, but it was hard for me. I was asked by my family members what I thought about this early in January. And my understanding just changed, and it's high responsibility that I'm learning with that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we're getting played up. So remember, everybody, safety is not guaranteed. There are calculated risks, but science is trying to help. So that's all we've got time for today. Thank you to my co-hosts, Kevin and Ari,
yep,
engineer and news chaperone, Shally. Shout out to Ari's pet rat, Newton, who crossed the Rainbow Bridge to dine in glorious mead halls with the other warriors in Rat Valhalla today. Hear, hear, Newton. Stay safe.